we haven't passed all those laws yet, so it can still be me.
She's not an employee.
Oh,
all day long.
Well, that's right.
Good morning. I'd like to open the House Committee on Business and Labor, Wednesday, February 25th. Good morning, committee. We're going to start out this morning with a public hearing on House Bill 2798. So I'll open that hearing.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure modifies the percentage rate and the amount of fees a pawn broker may charge for the storage and setup in connection with pledge loans. There are no amendments before you.
Oh, I guess Danelle and Flynn Case and Rick Blackwell. Josh Pulling. I didn't see that there. This is not good for me to.
Off to our usual start.
Yes. Trying to read. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Danelle Romaine. I represent the Oregon Pawn Brokers Association along with my father. I apologize, he's not here to entertain you this morning. He is in the building. I have two pawn brokers with me today who can really talk about the details of how these two fees work in real life. But I wanted to explain kind of the process we've gone through with DCBS. We started talking about increasing these two fees. We're talking about the storage fee and the setup fee. And I passed around a little one-pager on a little bit about those two fees. But basically what we did first is we surveyed the members of the Oregon Pawn Brokers Association to see how both of these fees have not been increased, one since 1998 and the other since 2009. And because all of the pawn fees are set in statute, we have to come to you every time we need to increase them. So we basically started by surveying all the members of the association. The association represents about two-thirds of the pawnbrokers in the state. And we asked them how their costs had increased. That's what's before you, basically, in this white paper. It talks about, property taxes, rent, security costs, insurance costs, wages for employees, how their costs have increased since these fees were set. And then we took a proposal to DCBS. We worked through some of their concerns about not affecting small loans. And we think we've come to a good compromise in this bill. I think DCBS will speak to that. They are officially neutral on the bill. We try and never bring a pawn bill to you unless we've worked it with DCBS and they feel comfortable with it. So we believe that's where we are today. And with that, I will let these two guys talk about how the business works and answer your questions.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Flynn Case, and I'm here representing All That Glitters Jewelry and Loan. We operate five stores in Salem, Portland, Tigard, Milwaukee, and out towards Gresham. I've been in this business now for close to 30 years and seen it evolve to where we're now stars on TV with Pawn Stars and so forth.
You don't look familiar.
I don't know.
Well, out here in the real world,
we have, unlike, people showing up with 200-year-old guns and rare things from the attic, we have, the bus driver who comes in with his children's Xbox to get some money for groceries to make the end of the month, or the realtor with the big Rolex that's waiting on the next commission check. We deal with all types of people, but we've had extreme increases in our expenses of operating over the last 5-6 years with insurance costs, security costs. I now have to employ private security firms to reply to alarms because the police no longer do it, minimum wage increases, and so forth. At one point, until several years ago, we operated 8 stores, and as a consolidation of costs and profitability, I cut down to 5, got under 50 employees for other insurance concerns, and we are trying to keep our company viable and serve there's a myriad of type of people that really need our services. And so we want to keep giving that customer service and take care of those people. As you have the list, you can see how much our costs have went up. And so we came up with this to not really affect our lower end borrower, but to give us a shot at making a little bit more money, because we're taking in like everything from the Rolex to the pressure washer today to try and stay in business and try and service everybody's needs. So we've seen that across the board. I operate in more metropolitan areas. Josh here can tell you they're kind of out in the rural areas and what they deal with, be it a tractor or an ATV. It takes up storage space, takes up real estate, has to be insured, has to be bonded. We got to pay the property taxes and that sort of thing. So we're here asking for your support for our bill to give us a little bit more revenue without hopefully taxing our customers too much. Josh.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Josh Poling, and I'm here representing Cash Connection. We operate four stores, two in Southern Oregon, one in Medford, it's actually in Central Point, and then one in Grants Pass. We also have two stores in Central Oregon, one in Bend and one in Redmond. So as Flynn alluded to, our perspective is similar yet different because we are in rural areas. And a lot of what we see and the customers that we help are blue-collar working people, people who are still trying to survive in the timber industries, a lot of contractors, laborers, those types of things. And the types of merchandise that we see are a lot different, too, typically a lot bigger. And that's one of the main reasons that we're pushing for this increase in storage, in the storage fee, because, you know, if I'm taking in chainsaws, tractors, ATVs, boats, trailers, those things are big, they take up space, and then, you know, I unfortunately don't own my real estate. I lease my real estate, and it just requires me to either lease different buildings, bigger buildings, or make a decision with what I can do for that customer. And unfortunately, that's not something that we want to do as an industry. You know, people come to us, they don't really have other options. Traditional lending doesn't service the niche that we service. Frankly, we're able to help these customers quickly, discreetly. We don't do any reporting. We don't require additional documentation. We're really dealing with the assets that they're presenting in front of us and making a decision with that. And it's important that we're not having to limit our ability to help these people by the size of the items that they're bringing to us. And I've done everything from tractors to boats, excavators, all sorts of big things that, you know, people don't typically think of. You know, they might think of gold watches, stuff like that. But in the rural communities that we service, there's not as much of that as there would be maybe in some of the bigger metropolitan areas. So with that said, just looking for you guys' support. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions? Just a quick question. So it looks like we're putting in statute a maximum charge of $250 for a setup fee, and then an additional $250 for a maximum charge for the storage fee.
Right.
So that's total $500, and it was $200.
Correct, but that would only be on a very large loan that would even take effect. The small loans, our average pawner is in borrowing around $100. The effect on them is going to be maybe a couple bucks.
Yeah.
And the guys, you know, we do hundreds of loans that are under $50, and there would be no effect on those at all. So it's, you know, we're trying to protect our little customer. You know, I got a little old lady who comes in and borrows $20 all the time because that's her copay for prescriptions, and it's the end of the month. I mean, that happens a lot.
So is it up to the pawnbroker then to individually whether or not they want to set up a sliding scale for these fees?
No, the fees are set, you know.
I mean, if they're under the maximum?
Oh, if they're under the max. Yeah, I guess you could, yes. You could not charge it. You know.
But they could charge the maximum on everything if they so choose. But the
No.
It's driven by the loan amount.
It's driven by the loan amount.
So the way the fees are structured is it's a percentage of the loan amount.
It's percent,
up to
5%.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Up to that $250.
So if the guy comes in with the excavator and needs $40,000, he's going to pay the $250. But the gal who comes in with a brass lamp and borrows $50, she's not going to pay anything more at all.
Okay.
You see the difference there? So it's not
going to
impact our low-end common customer. But if something comes up, you know, a boat, the big ATV, you know, something like that, then we're getting a little bit more for the handling and storage. Our business is almost totally a storage and retrieval business.
Right. So the loan amount's kind of capped by the percentage.
Exactly, yeah. The loan amount will deem how much
or
that storage fee is.
Okay, gotcha. All right. Not seeing any other testimony. guess you're off the hook.
Really? Well, thank you.
Or any other questions. Yeah, we do have somebody else signed up to testify. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rick Blackwell and or David Tatman.
If I may, I might like to bring my boss up to the dais as well.
I'm not sure I don't think you can order him around, really. Looks like he's going to join you anyway.
So, Chair Holvey and members of the committee, I'm Rick Blackwell, Senior Policy Analyst at the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and I'm accompanying my boss, David Tatman, who's the administrator. I'll be brief because the committee's got a lot of work ahead of it. We were approached by the Pawnbrokers Association on this bill in 2014. We worked together to find a solution that both addressed their concerns of rising costs and our concerns of cost to consumers. I have to make clear that we can't support or oppose measures that aren't approved by the governor, but we feel generally comfortable with the bill. And I think that's all I'd like to say. Thank you.
What did he say? Questions for Rick or the boss? Sorry. So I've got a question for you. So when we see these kind of bills come up that set exact fees in statute and periodically they come back to adjust those fees, I'm curious why we've never set a process up and, you know, that allows the agency to review these fees and then to adjust them. Rather than actually putting a set fee in statute. Has that ever been discussed, or is it people are just more comfortable having it established in statute?
Chair Holvey, we briefly discussed running this through the administrative rule process, which would allow us to adjust it every 2 years or less based on circumstances. Though, on the other hand, having it in statute is certainly gives certainty to the people that have to apply the fees.
Mr. Chair, for the record, David Tatman. So with the legislature meeting every year now, maybe the need to do that by rule isn't as great, although I will say within the 13 programs that we do have, most of them are done administratively through rulemaking in terms of setting fees rather than coming back to the legislature. So there's merit in what you say. Some of it's just a philosophical discussion. Some of it has to do with the comfort level of the industry involved. But I certainly understand your point.
So currently under rule, do you have the authority to adjust these fees? I guess if it's laid out in statute, you probably don't.
Chair Holvey, no. With it being in statute, there's no way for us to adjust it by rule.
Okay. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since you want them to have some questions. So anyway, because they said they did the loans off of a percentage. I mean, why couldn't we set it to that percentage of what the loan rate is or have a flexible between X amount and X amount of the loan amount? And then it doesn't matter if they want to do a $1 million loan, they could. Because I'm sitting here thinking what they're talking about, the big excavators, different things coming in, and having a cap at 250 doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So,
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, the initial fee, the fee that's currently in statute does have a percentage, but then at a certain point, the statute just caps it at a certain amount.
That's what I'm saying. The cap, why couldn't we just do away with the cap and just leave it at the percentage? Then they wouldn't have to come back here and ask for a raise or anything like that. It would just be based off.
Well, Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, it's certainly a policy choice the legislature could make. I think we would be, we'd have to look at it again to make sure the costs and consumers are appropriately addressed.
I guess my question would be,
May I follow up?
Would the agency have any issues with that? Is there a reason that this cap came into place?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, I actually am unaware. I think the cap is before my time. But again, I think the cap does provide some level of protection for consumers in that they know that they won't be paying too much for a setup and a storage fee.
Thank you. I have one other question in reading line 14 and 15 of the bill. I just want to make sure I'm reading this correctly. So is it your interpretation that for loans or excuse me, for the storage fee of not more than 5% for loans and loan renewals with a minimum charge of $2 and a maximum charge of $250, that maximum charge of $250 applies to both loans and loan renewals, or does it just apply to loan renewals?
Mr. Chair, that's a question I can't answer for you right now. I'd have to go back and research that. I believe it's just for the time of the initial loan because it remains in storage. The issue is having to take it in and out of storage, and as far as I know, they aren't going to be removing it from storage, so there should not be a renewal. But I may be wrong on that, so I'm happy to get back to you on that, or we might bring the industry back up to give you that answer.
Okay, I was just trying to clarify whether the $250 just, you know, you understand my question.
I absolutely understand.
The way the language is written, it's a little bit of a question to me. I want to make sure that what the language actually says, you know, legally, so that we're all in agreement of what it says.
Mr. Chair, I think there's an answer.
Yeah, I mean, we could have Danielle come up and tell us what her thought on that is. And if you'd reintroduce yourself for the record so I can remember
Chair
your name.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Danelle Romaine with the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association. Current practice is to charge it on both the loan and the renewal. I believe it says that in statute. And if you want to know how that practically works, our guys can come back up and talk about the renewal process.
Well, that wasn't really my question. It's just how the language reads, and I just want to make sure that the language is clear, that the agency and the industry and we all are in agreement of what that language actually says. So maybe we'll figure this out later and maybe ask legislative council to make sure that, you know, we're in complete understanding of what that actually means.
Chair Holt.
Okay. Representative Barreto.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, are these loans, are they monthly, annually? I mean, do they just vary? But what is, they bring in a piece of equipment, they put collateral, and then they take a loan on that and pay the fee and then come back and pay off the loan later in one lump sum? Or is there a payment by the month? How are these things established? I'm really unfamiliar with this.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barreto, it's set by statute, the length of time, and by statute there's a time period for renewal and a number of renewals that can be made, and so it is set up for a 30-day window of time and then can be renewed.
Every 30 days.
And there's a process for renewal. We just went through that 2 years ago in front of this committee, I believe, or I think it was actually the Consumer Protection Committee, where we set up some standards to ensure that was done properly. I can't tell you how many people do renew and don't renew. I think we'd have to turn to the industry for that.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Josh Poling from Cash Connection. So the overview of our process is, a customer comes in with a piece of collateral. We agree to a loan amount. Outside of that, everything's regulated by statute. So the fees, the storage fee, and the setup fee, and then the interest, those are all defined in statute on what we can do. And the interest is 3%. The storage fee, which we're proposing to increase, is currently at 3%, up to $100 right now. And then the setup fee is a 10% fee, up to $100. The loans are written for 60 days, and the first time the loan is written, it has an automatic 30-day grace period, is what the industry refers it to as. So the first loan's 90 days, at which point the loan can be in 60-day increments, and there's no number of renewal periods. What we find in our business is our customers typically use our services one or two times, so 90 days, 60 days, 60 days. In addition to that, probably the most surprising statistic to people outside of the industry is that in our business, as a state, and even nationally, the redemption rate on loans is 85% on average. So that means every 100 loans that comes in, 85 of those, the customer comes back and picks up. A big part of what we do is repeat business, and it's important that we're clear in what we're doing, which the state helps us, you know, by keeping the playing field even. But at the same time, with these increases in costs, it's become difficult for us to be able to help every customer at every time. So,
thank you. And just to be clear, Mr. Tapman, when I was speaking of that question I have about whether the 250 applies to loan renewals or loans or both, the reason I asked that question, because on line 12, there's no comma after the word renewals, and then in line 15, there is a comma after renewals, and I'm wondering if that makes a difference. And so we'll be asking legislative counsel, but I'd also, you know, inquire to the agency what their, if they have any past, you know, interpretation of that, or whether it's ever come up. I don't know, because I'm not understanding why there's a comma there in one and not a comma in the other. So any other questions, this group? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2798.
Have you ever been out to one? I'm sure.
Not seriously. I mean, I've been in there, but.
So I'd like to, committee, I'm going to go ahead and move into work sessions, and then we'll come back to the public hearing at the last. Do we have a bill introductions?
Yes.
So I'd like to open a work session for a work introduction of committee bills.
Chair Holvey, I'd like to move that four legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. I move that LC 2844, dated January 2nd, 2015, LC 3477, dated February 13th, 2015, LC 3500, dated February 16th, 2015, and LC 3724, dated January 22nd, 2015, be introduced as committee bills.
Thank you. Representative Barton moves LC 2844, dated January 2nd, 2015, LC 3477, dated February 13th, 2015, LC 3500, dated February 16th, 2015, LC 3724, dated January 22nd, 2015, be introduced as committee bill. Committee, this passing or voting in favor of this does not indicate that you are supportive or opposing such measures, simply our process for introducing bills into the legislature for possible discussion. Is there any other discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. And I'll close the work session on introduction of committee measures and open up a work session on House Bill 2007.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure was before you on February 9th. It makes disciplinary action against employees who inquire about or disclose wage information an unlawful employment practice, and it provides the employee a private right of action. There are exceptions in the bill. You have before you a proposed -1 amendment from the committee that clarifies that the exception is only for those employees who have access to wage information or other employees as part of the position's job functions, as opposed to their essential job functions. There is a -2, I believe, that would you like me to talk about the -2 or the person who's requested it?
Is it on OLIS?
It is.
No, up for an hour?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a...
Who would like to discuss the -2 amendments? Betsy Earls, please.
See a -2. Oh,
Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We have before you this morning the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2007. And if you, it's kind of hard to tell from looking at the amendment what it is, but if you look at the first page of House Bill 2007, it removes lines 9 and 10, which is the language that makes it an unlawful employment practice for an employer to basically take an adverse employment action against an employee for inquiring about, discussing, or disclosing in any manner their own wages or the wages of another employee. The reason that we wanted to do this is because if you see in the very next two lines, it also makes it an unlawful employment practice to take an adverse employment action against an employee for making a charge, filing a complaint, or instituting an investigation, which are all, fairly solid things. They're written down. They're, something that you can point to. But our concern with lines 9 and 10 is that you set up a situation where an employee could go to an employer and say, could I have a raise? And the employer says, no, or I can't afford it, or something like that. A few weeks later, the employer, denies some other request that the employee has, perhaps a request for a vacation, or does something else that the employee perceives as retaliatory, whether or not it's connected at all. And at that point, the employee could have a cause of action under this for an unlawful employment practice against the employer for retaliating against them for the discussion about wages. And honestly, you heard in the hearing that discussions about wages among, probably among employees to some extent, but between employers and employees are something that happen every day. They're pretty hard to quantify unless you have something written down like what you've got in Section B. And we would like to just remove that language and make it a little bit less of a bear trap, if you will, to the employer.
It's good quality building. Thank you. I think I'd like to call up the Bureau of Labor and Industries, too, since...
Could I ask? I'll wait until questions for Mr.
Certainly. Go ahead, if you have a question.
So I don't understand what this does. So, I come out of a... In my work world, everybody knew what my salary was. It was kind of public. So if I'm working at a company and I go, hey, Kenner, how much do you make? And he says, $4.10. And I go through and say, God, I'm only making $4.09. Now, does that mean that you could discipline me for something like that if that's taken out?
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Doherty, it doesn't necessarily mean that an employer could discipline you for having that conversation. Mm-hmm. What it means is that if you have that conversation and then the employer finds out about it and a few weeks or days or whatever later takes another adverse employment action against you or just says, no, you can't, does something you perceive as unfriendly.
Oh, so in other words, it's not through kind of implication that it was because of talking to Kenner that
right.
I was disciplined.
Mr. Chair and Representative Doherty, exactly. You would then be able to point back to that conversation and say, it was because of that conversation I had about 409 versus 410 mm-hmm. that you told me I couldn't take vacation. You're retaliating against me now, and that's an unlawful employment practice. So by removing this language, it would still give you room to file a charge that was the case or make a more formal complaint. And that would still be an unlawful employment in practice for the employer to have done that. But it firms up the process a little bit and doesn't just leave it to something that's discussed.
Could I just have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Can I talk to him about my salary and ask him what his is?
I think that's entirely, Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, it's entirely up to you and your employer and your colleague at the moment.
Okay. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, I'm curious whether you have any position since the commissioner sponsored this bill on these amendments.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We have significant concerns with the Dash 2 amendments. This is the first I'm hearing about it, so.
I'm sorry.
The very purpose of this bill was to make sure that employees were protected when they are discussing their salaries amongst each other. I feel like it I have some concerns that this amendment could eliminate that very protection that we were trying to get at, the ability of people to communicate amongst each other so that they can have some real solid information about whether or not they are making fair wages for amongst the sexes is an important element. So I would say that that is our primary concern. I haven't had much time to sort of process what this amendment would do, but I do think that it eliminates a lot of the oomph of what this bill was intended to do.
Can you comment on the dash one?
The dash one is a fine amendment. I don't have any problems with it.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Fagan.
Mostly just a comment. So if we were to delete, as the dash two proposed, if we were to delete lines 9 and 10 and make it where the, I think it actually has a effect to make employees have to be very litigious, because if I was to all of a sudden learn about, I better go quickly to make it sure my activity is protected, I better go quickly file a charge or an investigation, as because that's the only way that it's protected activity. So I feel like it actually has an it makes a very contentious relationship between, otherwise, you know, instead of just discussing with my coworkers being protected activity, to protect my activity, I have to go somehow take action against my employer. Which I don't, that to me is actually not something that businesses would want to have to encourage their employees to do. And then second, the example you gave, I think the case law is pretty clear that adverse employment action is a real thing, and just saying you can't take vacation, it, you know, is not, I mean.
That was probably a misuse of that term.
Right, but that's not an adverse employment action. I think the case law is pretty clear there, so.
No, Representative Fagan, you're absolutely right. I was trying to shorten up the amount of stuff I was reading to you. That's all there was to that.
Other questions? Representative Barreto.
Yeah, to me, the whole bill just seems to be a bad bill. But back in 2009, we were hemorrhaging. We dropped 70% in sales in our business. And I had one employee who'd been working with me for me for 20 years come and ask for a raise, and I said, I can't afford it. And his morale got so bad, we had to ask him to leave for 6 months. And he left for 6 months and then came back with a different attitude. But this could have easily applied to that. And it wasn't, and actually, when he left for those 6 months, all of a sudden, the place got to be a pleasant place to work. I mean, one employee can basically destroy the morale. And I look at this bill, and I think it seems like it just opens up opportunity for low morale in the workplace. I mean, that's, or it would lead to that.
Mr. Chair, I think our concern with the two lines that we're talking about eliminating is that they would have a chilling effect for employers dealing with employees on conversations about wages.
Thank you. Not seeing any other questions. Thank you very much. I appreciate your engagement. And, hope you have a good morning.
Can I make a motion, Mr. Chair?
I think so, yes.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2007.
Representative Barton moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2007. And discussion. We've had a little bit of discussion already. I believe we'll probably need a roll call vote on the Dash 1 amendment.
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Doherty.
No.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
For the dash one, yes?
Yes.
Oh, is this the dash ones or the dash twos?
Dash one.
It's the dash one amendment.
Oh. Dash one.
Okay. You rebel, Doherty.
Representative Doherty, would you like to change your vote?
No.
Sir, one versus two. Aye, please.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative
Fagan? Aye.
Representative Byrd?
Aye.
Representative
Knost? Aye.
Representative
Widener?
Aye.
What's that?
Vice Chair
Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kettleman?
Aye.
Chair Holden?
Aye.
Yeah, but this is a dash two.
Dash one amendment is adopted. Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2007 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves that House Bill 2007 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener.
I think this is something we probably should wait on because Foley didn't even have a chance to even look at the dash twos or sort things out, and it sounds like we could have some issues with employer and employee relationships, so I will be a no on the bill.
Other discussion? Seeing none, Matthew?
Representative Barreto?
No.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
No.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
No.
Representative Noss?
Yes.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Kenner?
No.
Chair Holden?
Aye. House Bill 2007 is passed and moves to the
what
floor.
What was the dash one? Because I didn't see that.
Carrier. Thank you, Representative Fagan.
Yep. Oh, I would actually like to.
No, I actually would like to.
Yeah, that was good.
That was silly. I thought I heard your voice.
Nice work. That was
nice. Then I'll close the work session on House Bill 2007 and open a work session on House Bill 2544.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure was before you last week. On the 13th. It requires that issues subject to collective bargaining during the term of the agreement that are not resolved through negotiations or mediation to be resolved through binding arbitration. And it requires the matter to be submitted for mediation before binding arbitration. Prohibits the public employee from striking when an issue subject to collective bargaining during the term of agreement is subject to binding arbitration. There are no amendments before you. There is no revenue impact. There is a fiscal statement issued. There's no subsequent referral. And there is, for the record, a letter of support from the AFT Oregon, American Federation of Teachers Oregon.
Thank you.
No amendments to discuss, correct?
No amendments.
Would you like a motion? Can I make a motion, Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2544 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2544 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Matthew?
Representative Barreto.
I'm sorry. I wasn't...
2544.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
No.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative
Hurd?
No.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenner?
No.
Chair Holden?
Aye. House Bill 2544, having received the votes, is passed to the floor. And Representative Doherty?
Sure.
Thank you. With that, I'll close the, Representative Doherty will be the carrier, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2544, and open a work session, open a public hearing on House Bill 2469.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure establishes a requirement for certain insurers to conduct an own risk insolvency assessment and to file a report of the assessment with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It specifies the conditions for sharing reports and the related information, and it requires reports and information be held confidential by the department and others that have possession of that information. It becomes operative January 2016, declares an emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments, and for the record, you did receive a letter of support from the National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies that is on OLIS.
Thank you. Representative Barton, who's up to testify?
Janet Holman.
Excuse me.
No problem.
K. King.
So, Jeanette Holman and T.K. Keene.
Yes.
Good morning, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is T.K. Keene, and I'm the Acting Deputy Administrator of the Oregon Insurance Division. Along with me is Jeanette Holman, who's one of our senior policy analysts. Unfortunately, Commissioner Callie could not be here today. She's traveling out of state. So we are here before you today to discuss House Bill 2469. It's a very technical piece of legislation that changes the insurance code that allows us to better monitor the financial stability of insurance companies. It is known as the Own Risk Insolvency Assessment, or ORSA. It helps the division ensure the stability of insurance market and protects consumers by ensuring the stability of the market, and requires our largest insurers to file annual assessments of their exposure to risk that detail how they will track and manage risk and how they will capitalize to offset their risks. The assessment would allow us to gather information about an entity's risk management framework across an insurer, understand how the insurer monitors risk and its ability to bear risk based on economic factors and operational changes, and understand risk exposure in normal and stressed scenarios, key assumptions, and risk mitigation strategies. It requires those insurers that are part of a holding group to assess the risk of the entire holding group, including the financial performance of non-insurance affiliates within that holding group. It does not require every insurer to file this assessment. We believe that likely only this would only apply to six. It's based on the volume of business, and it is scoped out that way because the goal is to gauge the health and stability of the market. Only those individual Oregon insurers that write more than $500 million in annual direct, written, or non-affiliated assumed premiums, or insurers participating in an insurance holding group with more than $1 billion in combined direct, written, or non-affiliated assumed premiums would need to file with the division. We would be able to take any necessary regulatory action based upon these filings to protect the market and consumers. And it's based on a model statute from our accrediting body, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and is considered a best practice. We also have some amendments coming to you involving insurer reserving, and we'll get back to you with those and be back to discuss those once those are completed. Finally, I'd just say that stakeholders have raised concerns about the confidentiality provisions of the bill, and we will be working with them at the same time we're working on the amendments to address those concerns. So with that, I'll take any questions that you have.
Questions on this? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is just kind of going through this at first glance. Have we ever had a health insurance company fail in the state of Oregon?
I'll let Annette or Jeanette address that.
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, we have had insurance companies, health insurance companies, and probably others who have gone into what we can call a hazardous financial condition. And at that point, we take over some of the management of the company, and the company is either dissolved in their policyholders are distributed to others in the area. I think the last one I know of was 2 or 3 years ago. So, yes, the answer is yes, we have.
And could you identify yourself for the record so the public knows who's speaking? Who just
I am so sorry. I am Jeanette Holman, Senior Policy Analyst for the Insurance Division.
Thank you.
If I may follow up.
Follow up.
So 2 or 3 years ago, we had one fail, or you saw they were weak going through your regular financial exams that you do of these insurance companies?
That's correct.
They failed.
They failed. They quit doing business in Oregon. I don't know if they're continuing in other states. We worked with the company to redistribute any remaining policyholders or insureds to other companies who were willing to take them.
No.
Thank you. Representative Burton.
Thank you, Chair. Now, is this model legislation that is being implemented in other states? It looks that way. It feels that way to me, but I don't know if that was clarified.
Yes, Chair Holvey, Representative Barton, it is model legislation from the NAIC. And so at this point in time, we have over 42 states that have either passed it or are committed to passing it.
Thank you. Other questions? And the bill references this manual, Own Risk Insolvency Assessment Guidance. I assume, maybe I shouldn't assume anything. Who produces that manual?
Chair Holvey, that would be the NAIC, I believe, that would provide the guidance on that.
So it refers back to the national consensus of best practices.
Correct.
Around this that the NAIC, is recommending or other states are adopting.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. So it's not a manual that you produced.
That's correct.
All right, other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bartner.
Thank you. Just because we don't have the national, we don't have the model legislation, we don't have a red line version of this bill as it might compare to, for example, the model legislation.
I'm just wondering, is there?
Obviously, there would be some that would be Oregon specific, for example, in Section 2 where we talk about other Oregon statutes. But in any substantive way, has this bill diverged from the model legislation? Anything that we should discuss or note?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barton, what we take the model language mm-hmm. and we do put it into the Oregon provisions. One of the issues with the confidentiality provision in this bill is that every single model act that comes out from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners includes the same confidentiality provisions. We already have those in our statutes, so that's one really good example of how we don't duplicate them every time we adopt a model act. We try to work them into what we already have. I do not believe we can't stray too far from the model act mm-hmm. and have it counted toward maintaining our accreditation.
Okay. Mm. And the importance of that accreditation is, I assume, to enable insurance companies to work in several different states and, sort of a streamlining process for the convenience of the insurance company so they don't have to comply to so many different types of regulations in each different state if they weren't able to coordinate among the states. I'm assuming that's the purpose of, this type of model legislation.
Chair Holvey, that's correct, and it also makes our work, by virtue of being accredited, usable by other states. So it really prevents the duplication of other work. As you've pointed out, having to comply with a variety of different state laws would be problematic. So
Representative Barton, would you fell short of asking for a copy of what was presented as model legislation to kind of look at. Are you curious to do that in your spare time?
Mr. Chair, I've worked with DCBS in the insurance divisions many times through the years. I trust them. They've never misstated facts. I gather from their testimony that they are doing their best to substantively comply with the model legislation. They haven't made policy choices in there that we don't know about. I take them at the word.
Good enough. Just trying to push you in a different
direction. Nice try, Mr. Chair.
Just making sure you have enough to do. any other questions? Not really seeing any. I appreciate your testimony and bringing it up forward and explaining it to us. It is perhaps a little bit complex to read this bill and trying to understand it. So I'm glad you're bringing some amendments forward, and we'll spend a little more time on it later, probably.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, Tom Holt. And whoever else would like to join Tom Holt.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. Ours is one of the handful of companies that would be filing these reports. I'd like to give you just a little bit more flavor of what this does and what it doesn't do. The division is correct that this largely follows a model act that's been worked out over the last year at the level of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. We're certainly supportive of the direction of the model and what it does, because it would give our regulators, you know, more insight into our business beyond what they already do. We are, for example, subject to periodic detailed financial audits where OID staff come and live at our offices for a few months and go soup to nuts on how we're doing from a financial perspective. What the risk assessment does is look at what's our strategic view of the world, of, you know, what risks might we face? What's the likelihood, for example, of an epidemic causing very large claims costs? Or are there competitive pressures that we're under? We'll look at what are our opportunities to grow our business. So there's a lot of very, very sensitive, competitive trade secret information that our competitors would love to get their hands on, and I'm sure our people would love to see it from other competitors, yeah, too, were it not confidential. And that's where the confidentiality provisions are really important in the Model Act. Our council has reviewed the bill, and our view is that at minimum, to really nail down the nature of the sensitivity and confidentiality of the information that would be in these reports, that there should be at least a cross-reference to the broad confidentiality protection in Oregon insurance law, so it's abundantly clear to anyone who may be interpreting this particular section of statute when it becomes law, that this is stuff that has to be handled very carefully and with kid gloves so that it doesn't get places where it would do damage to the market. The other departure from the model is one we've discussed with our financial examiner. On page 2, lines 35 to 37, the bill says that we would file our reports in April of each year. And what we have discussed with our examiner is that it would benefit the division to leave that silent as the model bill does, or to put a later date in the year. The reason for that is that around the end of the first quarter of the calendar year is when we close the books on the prior year. Once we've done that, we go through our annual risk assessment process. So we would like the division to be able to get the most current risk assessment possible from us and from others who are subject to this risk assessment process, rather than, in effect, with an early deadline in the calendar year, basically providing almost year-old assessments to the division. I think those are fairly simple changes that can be done with amendments, and we're happy to hear the division being willing to work on the confidentiality piece. We've had conversations about the other piece I mentioned. We think this can be put into form that we can all support. In its present form, we could not support the bill for the reasons I've outlined. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Would you like to provide testimony?
I would, Mr. Chair. Thank you for letting me come up here and join my colleague, Tom Holt. My name's Elise Brown. For the record, I'm here for AHIP. AHIP is the National Trade Association, America's Health Insurance Plans. And I echo my AHIP members' comments, Tom Holt. But let me first start by thanking the insurance division and specifically Jeanette Holman for working with us, working with AHIP and AHIP members on this very important issue to us and to the insurance division, and even more so for Ms. Holman's patience with all the questions and concerns that have come forward and her responses to those. I think AHIP admittedly has been the most persistent in the questions, and those that relate to where are the confidentiality cross-references in the bill that we're talking about today. So I am pleased to hear the OID say that they're going to look forward to working with carriers, and we look forward to working with them to ensure that at a minimum, we see cross-reference to the confidentiality or ORSA segments in the bill. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, my question was, I mean, I didn't realize we had issues with health insurance companies here till we just had testimony. I was thinking, I mean, very seldom do you ever hear of anything like that happening. I'm just wondering, what extra information they're going to get that they do not get from their periodic review that they do on insurance companies right now, because I know you guys are watched very closely and they check your financials to make sure you're going to remain solvent and stuff. What are they gaining from you that they wouldn't gain from their normal periodic review?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, I think in general terms, what the division would get is insight into carriers' business strategies. They would get insight into what we see as risks that have not yet occurred but are on our radar as possibilities, versus the financial examination is looking at what's actually happened and what's happening at that time. So it's more of a projection, might be a way of putting it, than it is retrospective, as the financial exams in part are. That's probably a little bit of an oversimplification, but I think that would be the key difference, is the insight into our strategy in the marketplace.
Representative Noss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, what would be the... This seems like a much more important bill than I thought it was before I got here, so I appreciate the testimony because I'm getting a lot of insight into this. What's the consequence of not passing this? I think that would make it clear for me.
Chair Holvey, Representative Noss, I'm hard-pressed to describe an adverse consequence from the bill not passing. I think it's helpful information for the division to have, as well as other state regulators in the other states where we operate. This bill is passing and going through in a number of states. It's added information beyond what they have now. You know, for us, we've been in business with our Blue Cross and Blue Shield plans for almost 100 years, so we're not especially worried about something happening, you know, next year to us.
The insurance division may have a different answer to that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's certainly
helpful information. I don't want to, you know, be perceived as denigrating its usefulness. I think it is helpful for the
division can come up.
I think that'd be appropriate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, and members of the committee. Again, my name is T.K. Keene, and I'm the Acting Deputy Administrator of the Insurance Division. This is an accreditation standard under the NAIC guidelines for us, and so that would put at risk our accreditation and then, therefore, our work in other respects and the transferability of that work. So it is an important bill to us to make sure that it gets passed.
So I would
follow up. Thank you.
So I would assume... if your accreditation were to lapse or go away, that would negatively impact insurance companies as well as the insurance division.
And the public.
Yes,
yes.
The public.
Yes.
So, thank you.
Appreciate
that clarification. Other questions? Mr. Holt, real briefly, I can understand the cross-reference. Is it your counsel's opinion that without that cross-reference, the confidentiality piece does not exist or does not cover this? Or is it just more of a, I won't say a feel-good clause, but reassuring that it is pretty apparent in this particular section of the law?
Chair Holvey, it's our counsel's opinion that that's a gap in the bill that would be easily fixed with some cross-reference.
And without the cross-reference, the confidentiality doesn't really apply?
Chair Holvey, without some kind of cross-reference, our counsel's view is that the confidentiality would be very vulnerable to being put aside, and that's our concern.
Okay, fair enough. Well, thank you very much. Fascinating bill.
I don't know how we're going to face the rest of the day.
Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill
2469? Yeah, we've had
standards. Good morning.
Good morning.
If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is John Mangan. I'm Regional Vice President for the American Council of Life Insurers. We represent 280 or so life insurance companies, most of whom do business in Oregon, and write the majority of life insurance, annuities, a lot of long-term care and disability income insurance. And we simply wanted to echo the support for this bill, also to acknowledge the hard work that Ms. Holman has been doing on this bill and many others to get it into shape, to match, make sure it matches the model. Our industry consistently supports stronger, more effective, and uniform regulation of our companies. That's good for the state. It's good for our industry. It holds us to a high standard. And the accreditation process that just came up is very, very important to companies located in Oregon, because if Oregon is not accredited, then their status when they go try to do business in Washington or Idaho or Kansas is called into question. So that can lead to bad market impact on Oregon companies trying to sell out of state and bring that revenue home to Oregon. So we obviously support the accreditation process. And we note that it's led to a stronger industry since it was implemented in the mid-90s. With those comments, obviously we support the ORSA model bill, and we support the efforts to tighten up the confidentiality materials as well. Our companies will be presenting, opening their books, in essence, and opening their strategies. And they're willing to do that because of the assurance that that information will be used confidentially by the regulator. I also wanted to mention that we support the division's further amendment on principle-based reserving. It's an actuarial topic, which I probably don't want to open for you today because it's a long and even more complicated issue. But it's also a model act. It will also strengthen the regulation of our companies, and it will likely help us more accurately price our life insurance products, more likely on the downside, which is a good thing. So we're happy to come back and discuss those amendments when they come before you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think we've exhausted our interest at this point in time, and we'll be anxiously waiting at amendments. Seeing no one else ready to testify, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2469. Jan, do we have any items for upcoming? Okay. With that, committee, I'll adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.
Yeah. Do you want to talk now?
Oh.
Till.
On Business and Labor.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk now? Oh.